Hey, folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Mason. As you'll hear, Adam Campbell here grew up in Nigeria and now lives and loves the Canadian Rockies. And by the way, this episode is from Without Compromise, my other podcast that I host through my day job at Athletic Brewing. A lot of times we have guests on that show that would just be a really good story here as well. So I say, hey, why not share some of those episodes over here? So if you're interested in hearing some other shows, I talk to NFL players, all sorts of athletes, folks from our community at Athletic Brewing. We make non-alcoholic craft beer. If you're interested in that, check out that show. It's linked in the show notes. But this interview was really interesting because we're talking about something that we don't often talk about on either show, really, and that is loss, death in the adventure sports and the things we pursue. And Adam has faced personally a tragedy to himself by falling off a mountain and also to loved ones. So as we're going to hear, a pretty tragic incident happened in the mountains. We're just talking to him about what that experience was like, what he learned, and how he moves forward from that. Because, you know, something can happen, and it can change the way you look at these places. And how do we continue to move forward, falling in love with ourselves, our passions, and the places we love, despite the things that can happen and sometimes do happen in these places? So I hope you learned something from today's episode, and I appreciate Adam being on. Adam is quite a legendary athlete in Canada. He's been on the Canadian national triathlon team, has competed in all sorts of things, done all sorts of amazing adventures, athlete for Arc'teryx, Athletic Brewing, of course, and has done just some overall amazing stuff. So thanks again, Adam, and yeah, enjoy the episode. Adam Campbell, welcome to Without Compromise. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Looking forward to this.
Where are you coming from? Where's home for you?
At the moment, I'm calling from Squamish, British Columbia, and I've been living here since December of this year, or I guess of last year. And but prior to that, I was in Canmore, Alberta, so in the heart of the Canadian Rockies. And yeah, for a number of reasons, I felt like a change, and change to the Coast Mountains has been a good one. Squamish is a pretty special place, especially come summertime here.
How different is it than Canmore? A lot of folks would say, well, you know, one Canadian mountain town to another, how much different can it be?
Well, I mean, when you look right from Canmore, you're looking at the prairies. When you look right from Squamish, you're looking at the ocean. So that's already a pretty big difference. And then, you know, from a practical standpoint, you've got really different climates. So Canmore is at a little bit of altitude. The rock there is heavily glaciated limestone peaks for the most part, and much colder, harsher winters. Whereas Squamish, you're dealing with coastal granite for the most part. There is other types of rock, but so a really different style of rock. And then obviously more coastal climate, a little bit more Pacific Northwest like, and you know, got like big rainforest. So spectacular, beautiful old growth trees, and just really, really lush. You know, it's darker and rainier, whereas Canmore is a little bit more, you know, for American audience, a little bit more like a Colorado or a Utah, you know, quite sunny, but cold winters for sure.
And so I read that you're a sufferer in beautiful, you like to suffer in beautiful places. When did that start? I mean, was it just growing up? Because in that area, I'm sure it's unavoidable, but when was it for you that it was a conscious decision?
Yeah, I actually grew up in West Africa. I grew up in Lagos, Nigeria, which is about as far away from the mountains as one could imagine. It's I grew up on the ocean in West Africa, so in a completely flat part of the country, with you know, the water was tropical warm, the weather was tropical, so you're only a few degrees above the equator. But from a really young age, we didn't have television growing up, and I spent all my time outside. So I think I've just always equated, you know, like play and recreation and just sort of happiness with being outside. And, you know, at first that was like surfing and, you know, or playing in the, you know, the youngest age, like, you know, making little sandcastles in the ocean and sort of burning your feet on the hot sand, you know, then playing in the shore break waves, and then starting to, you know, surf a little bit in the beach breaks there. And then later on it was sailing. And so I think I've just always enjoyed, challenging myself in nature. And frankly, it's, you know, like nature always wins. you know, so it's sort of, you know, developing a deep respect for it and just sort of seeing if you can, I don't know, endure what nature has to give to you and sort of developing the skills and respect to sort of work with it as well.
Gosh, that's really awesome. I did read that, but I must have skipped just preparing questions around it. But I do want to know, you know, what drew you back to Canada, or what was really the experience growing up in Nigeria, like a totally different environment, like I said, culture and everything.
Yeah. So my parents are both Canadian, and they moved there when I was 9 months old. My dad was worked for a telecom company, and they're putting fiber optic cables throughout West Africa, and later on cell towers. And my dad lived there for 43 years. He actually, he retired, but he now lives in southern Spain. So my dad's definitely a sun seeker to the extreme. But I moved back to Canada when I was 17. There wasn't really much of a proper high school, and my parents really wanted me to experience what it was like to be in Canada. And I actually ended up going to boarding school in eastern Canada, so an hour and a half outside of Toronto in this small town called Port Hope. And it was wonderful. I mean, it was kind of out of a movie, really. So Lagos, where I grew up, is, you know, one of the world's big mega cities. You know, there's almost zero infrastructure, and it's loud and it's chaotic. But we would go to Europe and to the Alps and to Spain for most of our vacations. But going to this really green, lush, outdoor, beautiful campus was just a really wonderful place. And that's sort of where I started discovering, like cross-country skiing and backcountry skiing and mountain biking, and started to discover a little bit more about organized sport, because I played a lot of sports growing up and I did a lot of activities, but there was no real organized sport per se. You know, we'd show up and play a soccer match, but there was no training. And so I started training for these other outdoor sports when I was about 17.
Is there anything you miss about Nigeria that Canada just can't provide?
The one thing that I had growing up, I grew up in more of an expat community, but so I had my group of friends growing up were really, really international. My best friend was Ghanaian, so he's from Ghana, and then my other best friend was Syrian, and you know, there's like German and Italian, so it was this really international upbringing. And that's a really, really unique way for a kid to be raised. And then the one thing that you also get exposed to is just like the deep poverty that exists in places like that. But just the joy of life that, you know, that people who have very seemingly very, very little from a Western perspective just have this richness of life and this incredibly deep culture. And just sort of, you know, even though like life is really hard for people, people also really look out for each other in places like that. And not that they don't do that in Canada, but I think that the deep appreciation for really, really simple things, you know, is often lost in us in Western cultures. You know, the more we have, the more we want. Whereas when you have absolutely nothing, you which a lot of people really don't, I think they just develop a really deep appreciation for life and simple pleasures. And I think that that's a wonderful worldview to have.
Well, tell us about, you decided to go back to Canada, 17 years old. Creating your own life. What started getting you into the mountains in the sense of like starting to do some of these ultras? How long was that kind of trajectory, and what were some of the milestones there? Because I know you were competitive from triathlons and being on, national sports teams, tons of them. What was kind of the trajectory there?
Yeah. So from a young age, like, as I said, all of our vacations happened in the mountains or in mountain areas. So I think also just kind of always associated mountains once again with like with play and vacation time. So, you know, there's just a real joy to being in the mountains. You're skiing in the winter or, in the summer going and hiking in the hills or sort of scrambling on rocks and stuff. And so I think I've always just sort of been drawn to mountainous areas. And my trajectory there, though, is when I was 18, I'd started, as I said, running cross country, and I grew up swimming in the ocean. So I've always been quite a strong open water swimmer, even though I wasn't a great like pool swimmer necessarily. And I entered a triathlon, and it happened to be the Junior Canadian Triathlon Championships. And I qualified for the national team at that race. So I had quite a good race, and I think just sort of my base level of fitness and, you know, maybe some lucky genetics and little bit of talent, and I made the national team. And So it was pretty cool as an 18-year-old, 19-year-old to go and compete at the World Championships and put on the Maple Leaf for the first time, even though I hadn't grown up in Canada. I always saw myself as a proud Canadian. And that same year, a young Canadian guy named Simon Whitfield qualified for the Olympics and ended up winning the first Olympic gold medal in triathlon in the year 2000. And I had started college that year, so university in Canada. And Simon happened to be from the hometown, Kingston, Ontario, where I was going to university. And he came out and trained with us after winning this gold medal. And like the rest of Canada, I watched him, sprint down the finishing chute and win this race. And, he sort of became an instant Canadian sporting legend. And here I was getting to train with him. And it was pretty awesome doing a cross-country running workout. He was like 6x3 minutes or 8x3 minutes or something like that. And not quite keeping up with him, but not also getting totally obliterated by him. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool that he probably hadn't been training for months at that point. He'd probably been partying, celebrating his gold medal, but I didn't think too much about it. I was like, oh, I'm hanging with a gold medalist here. And he invited me to basically fly across Canada and come and train with the Canadian National Triathlon Program. And I was like, well, that's kind of amazing that this Olympic gold medalist is inviting me to come train with him. And that sounds a lot better than, the statistics course I'm taking. And so I dropped out of school and flew across the country to Western Canada, to Victoria, British Columbia, and started training with him. And with sort of a long-term goal of trying to qualify for the 2008 Olympics. And I got to compete and train alongside some of the best triathletes in the world. Simon had this amazing way of gathering the best triathletes in the world around him, and they kind of gravitated there as well. So, he had the world, world champions and, national champions from around the world, really, and, Hawaii Ironman champions training there. And so I got this really deep immersion into what it was like training with the best athletes in the world and how to be a professional athlete and how to train really hard. And in about 2006, I realized that I just didn't quite have it, what it took to qualify for the Olympics. And so I kind of retired from triathlon at that point. I hung up my Speedo and singlet, and I became the national team manager. My partner at the time was, finished fourth at the World Championships the year before, and Simon was my best friend, and he had a pretty good shot at medaling again at the Olympics. And so I decided the only way to support them was to become a national team manager. So I did that, but I didn't want to give up on sports. And so I started jumping in trail running races, and I got to use some of my fitness and triathlon in the early days of trail running and trail running races. And it kind of just grew from there. I started first sort of big international mountain race was the World Long Distance Mountain Running Championships. And I think I finished ninth at that event at the Jungfrau Marathon. And then I started getting more and more curious about ultras, and that evolved over time. Started running 100-mile races in the mountains, and I started discovering that more and more of my runs were turning into scrambles. And so I'd always kind of rock climbed a little bit in climbing gyms and dabbled in it, but I got more and more interested in that rock climbing, and then that led to me doing more and more backcountry skiing and ski touring. And slowly, next thing I knew, I was probably spending more time doing like fast mountain travel than actually racing. Sort of became more of an alpinist, or sort of combining mountain running and alpinism and light alpinism. Yeah. So that's sort of a really, really quick summary of a more complex story, but it gives a general overview anyway.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
Hey, that was, I was following right along. I'm like, wow, this is so logical. You don't jump all over the place like I would if I told the story. So I appreciate that. Well, what do you think? I did read that you, as you progress, just like you just explained, your events and your activities became more and more wild based, more and more adventure based, less event-based. And so what do you think was drawing you to that that less organized experience?
I'd say a couple things. I mean, I'd competed for a very long time at that point at a very high level. And, I did sort of experience what it was like to race a lot. And I've always had a really adventurous, kind of curious spirit. And you know, as I was running trail running races and events, it was really cool, and I really enjoyed the competition and you know, the sport when I first got into it in around 2000, 2007, was really starting to see a big shift. You know, trail running was starting to take off, and these are like events like UTMB and you know, Western States were starting to get more coverage in mainstream media. People like Scott Jurek and Anton Krupicka and Kilian Jornet were starting to appear on the scene. And so, and there were, I think, also sort of around the time of, like, you know, YouTube was starting to happen. And so we're starting to watch these trail running videos, and it was really cool to see the growth of sport. And I think I kind of got caught up in that, and it was neat to be part of the competitive side of it. But after a bit, I was starting to get, as I said, more and more curious. I was just spending more time moving in the mountains, and you know, I'd be running across the base of you know, ridge lines, and rather than sort of staying on the groomed trail, I'd start, you know, scrambling up these ridge lines instead. And it was just a sense of adventure and sort of seeing where my body and feet and, you know, technical skill and courage or stupidity would take me. I just love looking at maps and seeing if you link up ridge lines, or, you know, sort of reading trip reports and hearing people who've done, you know, like a 6-day backcountry hike and seeing if you could do it in a day and that kind of stuff. I thought it just sort of felt really freeing. And I think having done such a, you know, sport at such a high level and in a really structured competitive environment, I just really enjoyed the freedom of still being able to push myself and challenge myself, you know, but doing it in a way where it's more in response to the terrain and nature and the environment you're moving in.
I know that you were doing a challenge with some friends when you had your accident, but up until that point, what was kind of your philosophy around danger, or did you have one, or just slowly progressing and learning and making good decisions in the moment is, you know, the best way to go?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I probably progressed too quickly into hardcore sort of mountain activities just due to the fitness, and then the people that I was lucky to be exposed to. One of my sponsors, Arc'teryx, is a very well known clothing brand in the mountain space. And so a lot of the other athletes are these like world renowned ice climbers and rock climbers. And so I got to go on trips with them and do things with them. And so rather than having a slow natural progression through, a more traditional mountaineering background, I kind of jumped into the slightly higher end of mountain sports quite quickly. And so even though I had the fitness with what I was doing, I think I was kind of lacking the, the really hard skills and the basic understanding. So I think probably the reality is I was able to get away with a lot, and I wasn't fully aware of the risks and dangers that I was putting myself into. You know, so basically you don't know what you don't know. And now with, you know, a bit more experience and time, I'm much more aware of sort of the early risks I was getting away with, and, you know, eventually didn't get away with, and I was really lucky to not die from that accident.
Well, you know, when I interview folks, I try not to, you know, ask the same questions that they've been asked a million times, but do you mind telling us some of that story, like what happened? I just think it's so powerful, and if you feel like revisiting it, I'd love to hear it.
No, for sure. So in August of 2016, me and two friends, Nick Elson, who's probably the best mountain runner, mountain athlete that most people have never heard of, at least in North America, and another friend, Dakota Jones, who is a world-class ultra runner, but he also has a very strong climbing background. We're in this area called Rogers Pass, British Columbia, and it's the birthplace of mountaineering in Canada. And it's a really, really beautiful alpine environment. And wanted to do something called the Horseshoe Traverse. And it's basically a link up of 14 peaks. And it is a mountaineering route. There's fifth class, up to 5.4, 5.5 kind of terrain, but with insane exposure. And, there's glacier crossings. And this route gets done on occasion. And it typically gets done in about, 4 days. And we were hoping to do it in a single push, and ideally sort of under 24 hours, because that was sort of the philosophy we like to take to things, was sort of moving light and fast. And, you know, by taking more of a trail running mentality into that environment, and leaving things like, racks and, heavy climbing gear behind, you can cover a lot more ground. but you're obviously taking much bigger risks as well. And we you know, our day started out really well, and we covered the first three peaks, and Nick and Dakota were slightly ahead of me, and we were going up this this little buttress called the Seltzer Tower. It's not even a main prominence. It's just a little rock buttress. And, you know, I wasn't paying attention. I was kind of rushing a little bit, and I ended up pulling out a block, and I wasn't properly secured and ended up falling about 200 feet down the side of this mountain. It wasn't a straight fall. It was a series of ledges, and I, you know, found myself tumbling down these ledges. And, you know, and when those sort of things happen, time, you know, stands still, but it also sort of speeds up. And I was conscious through the entire thing. I was wearing a helmet at the time, which would save my life. But, I was tumbling, and all of a sudden I realized I wasn't falling anymore. But I was face down in a pile of blood. And I remember not liking that. And I pushed myself and rolled myself over onto my back, and instantly realized that was a really big mistake. But I needed to just stand still. And, you know, luckily Nick and Dakota are, you know, some of the fastest mountain runners in the world. And they're also very skilled climbers. And they're able to get down to me really quickly and call search and rescue. And we have a world-class search and rescue crew in the Canadian Rockies. And they were able to get to me within 3 hours of my accident. You know, I was bleeding really heavily, but fortunately I, you know, just, and due to nothing I did, just really, really dumb luck. Like, you know, I knew I could wiggle my toes, but I was in a lot of pain, and they evacuated me and ended up in surgery for over 9 hours. And I had broken my back, T8 to T11 vertebra. And I'd fractured the top of my hip bone. A lot of internal bleeding, lacerations across my entire body from the rock, and it fractured my ankle as well. But I was alive, and I was conscious, and I wasn't paralyzed. So, you know, after the surgery, when I came to, I just, you know, I sort of had to deal with that for the last number of years. But all in all, you know, I was able to make quite a good recovery from the injuries. You know, never be able to compete quite of the same way or run the same way I could prior to the accident. But when you have to go through something that traumatic, all you do is, you know, sort of, well, it was a lot more important to have gratitude for the things I could do instead of really dwelling on what I wasn't able to do anymore. Because even on a relative scale, you know, even though I can't run the 4:30 minute miles I once could, I can still run. You know, and I think that there's, if I could just hike, you know, I'd be grateful for that. And so I try to make that my mind frame.
How did your relationship with the mountains change after that accident?
So, I mean, one, I realized that, you know, the way that I was moving in the mountains, there was a lot of ego involved. I was really trying to prove myself. I think I was kind of self-conscious, maybe, that I did lack the skill, you know, that a lot of other climbers had necessarily. And so I was trying to prove myself, like a lot of young people in the mountains do. And I instantly realized that, you know, they really don't care about who you are, what your CV is, you know, but they're a place that, they're just dangerous. They're just really, really dangerous environments. And, you know, you can move quickly enough, but you need to move really cautiously. And so I sort of rewound a little bit what I did. And I, you know, I sat down with a lot of these sort of, you know, mountain mentors. And I started from the beginning and started to try to really work on like my basic soft skills and learn how to approach the mountains in a safer, slower way. You know, and then hopefully progress from there. So I basically just treat them with a lot more respect than I probably previously did. Like, they're a lot of fun. Like they are sorts of like incredible beauty and awe. But one of the reasons why they invoke that is because they're very, very dangerous, harsh environments.
Your philosophy before, which was the more chaotic your life got, the bigger your goals would become, and the goals you would chase would be. And I guess that's where that maybe you let that go.
I mean, I won't necessarily say that I let my goals go in the mountains, but I think the reasons for doing them shifted. You know, rather than doing them to prove myself, you know, which I think, and being honest, was probably a large part of it. You know, I try to remind myself that it's more about curiosity and sort of being less attached to the outcome. I think it's still cool to try like rad things and to be inspired by hard lines and, but to not identifying yourself by the outcome. I think that was sort of the big mental shift that happened for me anyway. But I know a lot of people that have gone through mountain accidents who just never went back, and that's totally okay as well. But for me, that, you know, I've always, you know, they continue to be a source of beauty and strength and empowerment for me. And there's no sense of, like, you know, wanting to go back and conquer what I've done, but rather just go and sort of understand and immerse myself in them.
Did you think to yourself, like, okay, you know, a lot of people have a situation like this, an accident that really changes their life. Did you think, you know, I had that, it's behind me, it's done. Now I have to learn from that, and this is the rest of my life.
I don't know if I was so naive as to think that nothing could ever happen again. I think that'd be a really, really dangerous mindset to go into the mountains with. I think, you know, you don't know, you certainly never think you're invincible. But I, as I said, like, I continue to give them a lot of respect and to try to keep developing skills, you know, taking avalanche courses and rock rescue courses and weather courses and spending time with really, you know, like mentors and people who spend a lot of time in the mountains and sort of asking them questions and just trying to be like deeply curious about the places I move in, to try to minimize, the likelihood of something happening. But anytime you're in a risky environment, in high consequence environments, you know, that you try to stack the odds in your favor, but you can never guarantee, that nothing will ever happen. And, you know, and me and my friends and my partner at the time, Laura, talked about those things a lot. When you're out there, you're constantly like basically doing risk assessments and hazard assessments when you're moving in technical mountain terrain or in natural backcountry. Like, to give people context, the Canadian Rockies are, even though they're accessible, they're very, very wild, very, very harsh mountains. They're really, really remote and quite unforgiving. Wonderful places to prepare you for, you know, like the Himalayas, but places like the Himalayas are far less remote than the Canadian Rockies are. There's just thousands and thousands of kilometers and miles of uninhabited terrain, and much of that terrain sort of still unexplored by people.
Well, so you get through this accident and, shift in perspective, respecting the mountains more, maybe doing it less for ego. What were some of the goals then? What were you doing? I know you went out with friends, like you said, but what were some of the things you were putting yourself through at that point?
Backcountry skiing has always been a really big part of it, of my life, and sort of getting more into ice climbing and mixed climbing, and just sort of really learning to appreciate winter in a big way. But one of the big things that happened during that recovery process is I really, really understood the power of community and love in healing. Prior to that, I think I had this notion that I was this like strong, independent, this like fallacy really, but this strong, independent, athlete and with a very healthy ego. and I think, I definitely pushed a lot of people aside, people I loved and who loved me and cared for me and didn't really appreciate the role that they were playing in my life. And when I was lying in the hospital bed with a broken back and hip, and like I literally couldn't wipe my own ass, and just in like sheer agony and kind of quite afraid about what the future would, even though I had like a lot of gratitude of being alive, I was afraid about what the future would hold. And, just the caring touch from, these like, nurses and, support staff, to family and friends who drove like over 6 hours to come visit me, just really reminded me, and opened my eyes to the importance of community. And so I try to do a much better job at, showing gratitude and love for my community and spending time with the people that really matter to me.
Well, take us through that day that you experienced with Laura. But before that, I want to ask about how you met Laura, because it was not as frictionless as it could have been. I there was a lot of you had to pursue a little bit. She was not at all making it easy for you.
Yeah. So, prior to my accident in Rogers Pass, the year before, I'd met this wonderful woman. Her name is Laura Kozakowski, and we actually met online. And she was an anesthesia resident, so she was a doctor in training in anesthesiology, and she'd just come off a 30-hour shift, and we agreed to meet for a beer. And I remember seeing a photo of her, and she was like super beautiful, obviously incredibly smart, and really, really athletic woman. I was like, oh my god, this person's kind of perfect. And, you know, I'd actually sent her a message on the dating app, and she kind of hated the dating app. And so I don't think she ever really checked it, and I didn't hear anything back. But I noticed that we had some friends in common. And so I messaged one of my friends, and I was like, hey, do you mind putting in a good, this, like, try putting in a good word with this, with Laura, just sort of telling her she should probably meet up with me. And luckily they were a good wingman, and he did, and we ended up meeting for a beer at the Kensington pub, and she'd just come off a 24 or 30 hour shift and was absolutely shattered and was going to bail on it, but decided last minute to actually come. And I remember seeing her outside the pub and was like, oh man, she's even more beautiful in person than she is in her photos. And we ended up just having this really, really deep, meaningful conversation. And there's just like an instant sort of chemistry and attraction. But we were both just coming out of longer term relationships. And, you know, it was a little bit of, I'm not sure if either one of us was quite ready to move on yet. And, but we, you know, I knew that she liked, you know, mountain activity. She grew up as a competitive climber, but she played competitive hockey, and her dad was a mountaineer. And so we started going for some light ski tours and some rock climbing together, and ended up going and doing a few easy alpine routes together, and just had these really wonderful connections out in nature together. But, you know, then you get back to the valley, there's still a little bit of, and she was working a lot at the time as well. And I was also working as a lawyer. And so it was a little bit challenging to actually sort of to hold that same connection in the valleys as we could in the mountains. And so we were pretty hot and cold. But then when I had my accident, you know, I think it kind of just knocked both of us into being like, what are we doing here? You know, she dropped everything and came and helped and looked after me and helped me recover. And it really, really just bonded us in this really, really special way, and ended up getting married a year later. And, you know, she became one of my main climbing and backcountry ski partners, and we did a lot, and she could move like effortlessly in the mountains, and it was just a joy to be around. And you know, and we also traveled the world together as well. We were both, once again, like really just curious and adventurous people, and very much so, even though we were both professionals, we both very much had a work to live kind of mentality. So we would take months off to go and travel and climb and explore the world as much as we could together. And so yeah, just a really, really special, unique couple of years together.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
Well, I know that obviously you had an accident out in the mountains. I don't know how typically people approach asking you about that, but I do want to share with folks what happened, and if do you mind sharing some of that story? I know we don't have tons and tons of time, so I don't mean to bring it up before you start
No, that's okay. I mean it's totally fair. I've been quite public about it. In January of 2020, Laura and I, a friend of mine and I, were gonna go check out a new to us area. He's a ski guide in the Canadian Rockies, and just this wonderful, wonderful skier, and We've been talking for months about actually getting out together, but he has a really busy guiding schedule, and really hard for him to actually find time to go free skiing and ski for fun. And I finally had a day off, and so we agreed to meet. And Laura didn't have any work duties that day, and so she asked if she could come along. And so we were all really psyched to go and check out this area in Banff National Park at the base of Mount Hector, which is one of the bigger peaks in the area. And it's an area Mount Laura and I had climbed and summited a bunch of times, but we wanted to go check out one of the lower bowls. And in that time of year, you know, it was a really, really cold day, but it had snowed quite a lot. The avalanche conditions were, were considerable, which is, quite a touchy snowpack. But, you know, Kevin was a, you know, world-renowned ski guide. Laura and I had the highest level of recreational avalanche training, and I was on the board of directors of Avalanche Canada, and, skied, hundreds of days every year. So I had a pretty good sense of the environment and sort of risk management. And so we went out, and we're just hoping for a fun day of powder skiing in a new area. And we went and checked out one area, and we know some wind slab forming, and so we weren't really happy with that zone. So we moved over to a slightly different aspect, and you know, we sort of try to mitigate hazards as much as possible. And we skied these like beautiful chutes, and we had a good skin track in. So we started lapping areas and sort of progressively moving across this ridge line. And finally, you know, the wind started to pick up and the temps got cold, and, you know, we decided to sort of call it a day. And so final run of the day, we identified some hazards. We identified a little creek at the bottom and sort of pointed out an area that we were going to regroup in this clump of trees. And Laura skied first and, you know, skied this beautiful powder run down this this wonderful sort of small bowl, you know, somewhat sheltered bowl. And then Kevin skied second. And, you know, I watched Kevin. I moved forward to go watch Kevin ski because Kevin just rips and he's just a joy to watch ski. And as I moved forward to go watch Kevin, I must have triggered a small convex roll, sort of like a little weakness in the snowpack. And next thing I knew, the entire slope below my feet was avalanching. And so it ended up going about 80 meters, so almost 300 feet across this open face. And it ran the 400 meters of the bowl, so about 1,600 feet. And I started to get caught in the avalanche, and I quickly self-arrested on my ski poles. I was able to stop myself right above the crown of the snow. And I just watched this avalanche rip down the slope. And once the powder cloud settled, I started yelling, "Avalanche, avalanche." But they were both quite far down the slope. And so I quickly transitioned over to another aspect so I wouldn't trigger any secondary slide over top of them. And I skied down as quickly as I could. And when I got down there, I saw Kevin. And Kevin said that he saw Laura in the trees. We start yelling her name. And she doesn't respond. I yell again. She doesn't respond. And we quickly realize that something serious has happened. And so we pull out our avalanche beacons and start performing a beacon search. And we get drawn into this creek bed that we'd identified as a hazard. And the best reading that we got on our, so when you're backcountry skiing, everybody in a group wears these avalanche transceivers that send off a little signal, and there's either a send mode, and then if something happens, the other people in the party send it to search mode and starts looking for these signals. And the best signal that we got was 4 meters, which means that Laura was buried over 12 feet into the snowpack from us, and in this quite a steep cliffside. And so we both pulled out our avalanche shovels and started digging as frantically as we could. But it was quite a complex dig due to the steepness of the slope. So we ended up having to dig from almost 10 meters back, so almost 40 meters, 40 feet plus back, to tunnel in so that we wouldn't, so that the snow wouldn't just keep falling in. You have to sort of tunnel your way into the person who's buried. And so it took us, you know, almost 45 minutes to get to her. And when we got to her, her body was upslope, and Kevin, she was really blue, but Kevin was able to clear her airway and tried to perform, you know, he got a pulse. He told me he got a pulse. But in fact, in retrospect, he lied to me. And we ended up having to keep digging for another 45 minutes. And the second we got the 12-foot reading, I press send on my, I had an in reach with me, because there's no cell signal where we were. And so that had initiated a call to local search and rescue. And so after an hour and a half of digging, we finally got Laura out, and we tried performing CPR on her, and we got no response. And, you know, we took every bit of clothing that I had in my pack and tried to keep her warm. And I sat with her and held her and caressed her and tried my best to not fully collapse, because I thought that she was dead at that point. And finally, when the search and rescue crew went up, they were all friends of ours, and they recognized us, and that just absolutely crushed me when they saw who we were. And you could just see the look, even though they were all very professional, you could see the look on their faces that this looked really serious. And you know, it was obviously really hard and traumatic on them. And so they packaged Laura and flew her out, and then they came back and got Kevin and me. And when I was being long lined out, I completely collapsed and just absolutely just started crying and screaming and punching and kicking in the air. And Laura got flown to a hospital about 100 miles away. So we had some friends drive us to the hospital, and when we got there, they told us that Laura, you know, was in a really, really serious state. She had a very faint pulse, but they didn't, you know, they didn't, there was, they were going to do what they could to try, and they were trying to warm her at the time, but they didn't know if there was any brain activity. And the following day, they had to stop providing life support to Laura. Her bowels had died, and sort of the medical term, I'll never forget what the doctor said. They're like, that's incompatible with life. So they decided that it was that there was nothing more they could do for her. And so by this point, word had gotten out that to the broader community and friends and family that, you know, this had happened. And so we all basically just gathered around Laura and held her and sat with her and talked to her and, you know, supported her and slowly just watched as she died. I'm sorry. Yeah. So that was January 11th of 2020, and I've sort of been living with, you know, with the consequence of that. I mean, I triggered the avalanche and, you know, wasn't able to save Laura, and so then I don't think you ever really can. So also just in terms of the fact that you can't ever really make sense of it.
You know, I know that you've been asked about that so many times, and I hate to have to revisit it with you again, but, you know, what do you think, having gone through something so traumatic yourself and having gone through that, I mean, and that was right before the pandemic. I mean, that was just, gosh, blow after blow. What do you think you're learning about life through these experiences, or what do you think that you can share, that, you know what I'm saying? Like, what is maybe some of the overarching lessons that you've learned about this life that we're all living?
Yeah. No. I mean, I've been really, really, I've been really fortunate through a lot of my life. You know, I come from, I have a privileged family background. I got to experience some incredible highs. I've got to see large parts of the world. You know, I don't have to worry about putting food on my table or feeding my family. I've been really, really fortunate in that way. But at the same time, like, life can just be hard, and it can be short. And I really, you know, I kind of made a promise to Laura that I was still going to just try to have as much gratitude for, and try to experience as much of the life that she will never get to experience. And, you know, really, once again, as I did through my initial accident, really had to support and rely on my community and friends to see me through these incredibly hard times. And I just were reminded of how important it is to hold the people that you love close. And then also just to go and, like, try to find those, like, deep, rich life experiences, like the awe moments in life, but, you know, like the material things and the results and all that stuff doesn't really matter at the end of the day. Like, they're cool things to have, but what you really, really remember, like, the what I think about her, like, you know, the little smiles I got to have with Laura, and you know, telling her I love her, having coffee with her in the morning, and I really miss those things. So I think just trying to have, like, a real, real deep appreciation for those moments when you get them. And don't take those things for granted. Sorry.
No, those moments are what make up life.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, like, life is about love, ultimately, you know, but it is also about hardship, you know, like, that's also a part of it. Like, you know, it's not, don't hide from those emotions either. I think just accepting the fact that sometimes life is hard and sometimes things are shit. It's part of my language there, but they just are. And asking for help in those moments and allowing people to support you. And then supporting your friends as well when they're going through that stuff is really, really important.
Do you see people differently now? Just maybe not knowing what people might be going through?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's that classic saying that, you know, be kind. Everybody's going, like, you don't know what struggles people are going through. I do genuinely believe that. I think that, you know, we're all just trying to do our best. Like, everybody's trying to do their best, and we all kind of fumble our way along. Nobody has any of this figured out. And I don't think that there is a right or a wrong. Well, there's definitely some wrong ways to do things, but just try to be kind to people, have a lot of compassion for them, try to understand their viewpoint and where they're coming from. I think if you can do those things you may not agree with them, but at least you've given them sort of the dignity of trying and given them space. And I think that that can sort of, you know, open a lot of, well, one, it could open your eyes and mind to a whole new world of viewing, but also just showing people general kindness comes back to you in spades as well. And not that it needs to come back to you, but it generally does. And I think you just end up living life in a slightly happier, more content way.
You said, I heard you say before that life has always been about finding your edge. What is your edge now?
I don't know if it's about finding your edge. I think it's about just like deep curiosity. You know, and curiosity means sort of it being willing to explore slightly uncomfortable places and spaces. And so I'd say that's what it is. It's once again, it's just a deep knowledge, like wanting to have a deep knowledge and curiosity about what's around the next corner, what's somebody thinking. So just sort of placing yourself in positions to be able to explore those curiosities can go a really long way to leading a very rich and fulfilled life.
And, you know, I know you had really big goals before and you said you still do. What would you say one of your biggest goals you haven't yet achieved is now?
Probably having a family. I think there's one thing I'd like to have. It'd be that, like, you know, whatever that means. But I'd say that that's probably, once again, I don't think I'm really, I try not to be too concerned with like actual outcomes or things, but just, you know, at the end of my life, sort of, if I could have people say, you know, he was a kind, compassionate, curious, adventurous person, I think that would mean a lot to me. So I think sort of that, and I'm thinking a lot more about sort of my legacy going forward. So I'm no longer, you know, the athlete I used to be, but I'm sort of, you know, I just want to keep evolving and changing. You know, like I don't want to be the same person I was when I was 15 or 16 or 20 or 30. I want to keep evolving as a person and experiencing life to its fullest and sort of keep, you know, evolving and adventuring with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I tell you what, I'll wrap up with this. You know, on each can of beer at Athletic Brewing, it says brew without compromise. And we realized in order to brew without compromise, you need to live without compromise. And so considering all the life that you've lived so far and what you've experienced, what does it mean to you to live without compromise?
Well, once again, I just think it's like, you know, it's just, you know, dare to try. I think it's just, you know, don't be afraid to try new things. Don't be afraid of failure. Just put it out there. Try it if you're curious about it. Don't be afraid to be a beginner either. Like, it's actually really fun to learn new skills and develop, and you never know what sort of community may come from that. And in terms of the, it's interesting, actually, in terms of the non, drinking non-alcoholic beer, I mean, you know, having a cup of tea, having a brew is, to me, is all part of sort of the overall mountain experience, because that's like where community forms. It's where you share stories. And I've really, really tried to cut back on alcohol. Everything I've gone through, I definitely have dealt with some mental health issues and emotional issues. And I found that, you know, consuming alcohol, one, could be a potentially dangerous crutch for me. And I also just found it really affected me in quite a deep way. But I also just really love beer.
You're quite a predicament there.
Yeah, so non-alcoholic beer has been a wonderful way for me to sort of still engage in those pastimes and activities I really enjoy in a way that doesn't have a negative impact on me. In fact, it just kind of enhances my life, because when nothing I like better than finishing an adventure, getting back to the truck or getting home and, you know, opening a cooler or a fridge and cracking a beer and handing one, most importantly, handing one to my partners that I'm with, cracking it with them, and then start storytelling. And that to me is like, that's the peak experience.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.